This is 69, the podcast. I'm Dave Haynes. 69 has been covering the digital signage industry since the dawn of man, first online and now as a podcast. This podcast gives me the time to really talk to people about technology and issues, get past the PR and jargon, and into what stuff actually means. I try to help listeners understand why they should care. The podcasts are free and I try to get a new one out weekly, but I travel a lot so sometimes I'll miss a week. The 69 podcast has been gratefully sponsored and supported since the start by Jeremy Gavin and the fine folks at ScreenFeed, the digital signage content store. ScreenFeed makes beautiful looking, totally automated content for signage and digital out-of-home networks. Check them out at ScreenFeed.com. I've been working with both Avixa and Invitus for most of the year on a series of monthly roundtables called Digital Signage Power Hours. They've all been great, but the one we did recently on experiential media in real estate was particularly good because of the people who kindly provided their time. We had David Niles, who created and still works on the Comcast experience, one of the earliest and still one of the best projects out there involving LED in real estate. We also had Amal Hazelton, one of the big thinkers at the famed experiential creative agency Moment Factory. Sibel Jones, CEO of SEGD, was on, as was Jeremy Kolib, whose consumer experience group works with property companies on big LED projects. And we had Emily Webster, the Senior VP of Creative at New York's ESI Design, which is behind some of the best experiential real estate you're going to see. We could have chatted for hours, but we had 50 minutes. Listen, learn, and hopefully enjoy. So, hi guys. This is, to me, a really, really exciting topic because we've seen a lot of LED and a lot of big visuals go into big commercial spaces. And I've wondered, given what's been going on in 2020, what that means going forward. Is it the same because people are working from home now? Are buildings clearing out? All that stuff. I don't get the sense that's the case at all. So for those listening, this is an open roundtable. Please do put in your questions in the Q&A section and we'll try to get to those in about half an hour. But for now, I first wanted to ask David, you put together the Comcast experience in Philadelphia years before many people in this industry even knew what LED was. And I was curious, why did Comcast make that investment and what do they see out of it?
Good question. Comcast became the major tenant in a new office building in Philadelphia at that time. That was 12 years ago, where they were able to unite their entire staff, their entire management and staff into one new building. And the CEO, who had incredible intuition, wanted something to instantly make this new environment or this new building welcoming and welcoming to all of their employees, making them proud to be in this new space. The developer of the building wanted to create an instant destination in an area of Philadelphia that at the time was very cold. There's no shopping there. There's nothing. So that was the original challenge. One for Comcast to create an environment that would inspire, and for the developer of the building to create an instant destination. That was definitely the original goal.
And for those people who don't know the Comcast experience, it's like, I think you said 80 feet wide of LED, and it's like the whole back lobby wall of this big 80 story office tower.
Yes, it's a 1,000 foot tall office tower, a bright, bright tower that was built at the time, with an enormous lobby that was designed by Stern, that was originally just an enormous, almost five-story tall atrium area that was paneled in these enormous wood panels all the way around. And it was, the screen itself is just under 90 feet wide by about 30 feet high. And our first intent, and it was very important, is that the screen be photorealistic, that you could walk into this lobby and not see a screen. Mm-hmm. That thing that we would put up on there would be photorealistic in broad daylight, which 12 years ago had its challenges because it was just the dawn of 4mm LED.
Yeah, and to me, the magic of that is you walk into that
lobby and you're looking at this big wash of wooden panels, and the back panels aren't actually wood, they're LED, but they look like the wood panels on the side. And then all of a sudden there's little video sprites and things happening on these panels. And you're going, what the hell is going on here? I thought it was amazing. I'm sure everybody else on this panel has been somewhat inspired by that. And I wanted to ask Emily, your company, when I first came across you, we talked about different things that you were doing. And what I found really interesting is the property owners who you're working with and doing experiences in the lobbies, a lot of it was around tenant recruitment and tenant retention. The idea that there was a whole business model around having, for lack of a more elegant description, a cool looking lobby, a cool looking building that you felt good about being in. Is that kind of how things work?
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you look at sort of the history of the lobby of buildings, there are often spaces that people tend to move through and don't really consider an amenity to to your floor. And so our client really recognized that there was a lot of opportunity to think about the entire building, not just the tenant floors, in terms of what could be offered up as spaces for those tenants. And to take sort of the sterile, empty lobbies of the past and rethink them so that they're more active, they're more vibrant, and they can respond to the audiences moving through them and become a communications platform for the building, to really enliven the building itself, reposition it, and make the building a brand. So that was how we were looking at these properties, to look at ways we could reposition them and allow them to have a storytelling layer integrated into them. And that's how we define sort of media architecture, is introducing a digital layer into the built environment, allowing that space to have a voice. And every building that we look at has a different story to tell, and that's part of the work to design it. Allowing there to be a dynamic, changing story integrated into the architecture in a really intentional way is different than many of the other buildings out there. And that's sort of where we're looking at making the building have a really unique, identifiable sort of quality as you step inside, and allowing it to respond to people who are coming through that day.
But have your clients seen a cause and effect to this, that we did this and therefore tenant retention is up or recruitment is faster, all those things?
Yes. I mean, the type of audience that they're trying to attract is really looking for more amenities and more of a vibrant kind of space. And so they're able to go out and really target certain clients and show them the spaces, show them the renderings of the spaces before they're even built, to try to entice them either to stay or to come into this building rather than any other on the market. I mean, there's plenty of buildings out on the market right now. So why this building rather than another building?
Mm-hmm. Jeremy, you work out in LA, but I suspect you're working all over the place with property companies who are, you're advising them on the technology to use, but I you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you're also helping him come up with a monetization strategy that's not necessarily around a lobby, but it might be a big LED screen that's cladding a building or cladding a piece of real estate that's, you know, on just the perfect corner for media.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. I'm definitely working around the country on different projects. But when I look at a project, I look at the entire, as I like to say, from the curb to curb, from the time you arrive to the time you leave, and all the different touch points that a consumer might interact with, and where maybe those digital experiences could occur, from the outside facing, let's say, a major freeway to drive traffic to the property, to, let's say, the exterior of the facade of the building, to potentially a valet location, be it a hotel or a shopping center or a commercial property, to inside the lobbies. And then what are the experiences inside the potentially the rooms or the offices and so forth. But yes, working to figure out an ROI well ahead of the curve, and how do you integrate it into the architecture and so forth. And if we need to go change sign codes, we've done that successfully as well around the country.
So when you talk about experience for an outside billboard, a spectacular at a, you know, major intersection in LA or whatever, how does that translate from just being advertising to being experiential?
Sure. So we've had on a couple boards, we've had art up there a couple times, community messaging. Recently with COVID, we've had PSAs for the council member and the city and you know, numerous messages. So beyond just advertising, a lot of the time the real estate developer does want to figure out an ROI before they spend numerous amounts of money. So, you know, most digital signs are not occupied 100% with media companies and advertising. So you've always got space available to place in their art and public service announcements and other messages that are relevant for the community.
Okay. Sibel, with SEGD, your organization, member-based organization, it's full of like architects and designers and people who think about the experiential look and feel of a space. Are they now starting to bake in digital as a standard of what they're going to do, or is this still kind of like an add-on that maybe we'll do this too?
No, I think it really has become a standard. And I think, you know, even in the absence of people in our cities, we can see how digital activation of architecture is still allowing there to be a sense of place, right? So I think, you know, the way that we're able to create storytelling in physical environments and to respond to people's needs and people's moods, I think we understand as an organization that's really focused on that intersection of people and place, digital narrative is really critical. And it, I think it's going to be even more critical to building people's security around going back to work. All that messaging that Emily was talking about, and the ability to give information about, you know, social distancing or, you know, just things that people care about. I think the beauty is that we've moved to a more artful, expressive, human interest and even responsive digital platforms. And so that I see moving forward is really at the epicenter of how we create this placemaking and how we begin to communicate beyond the walls of the buildings.
Mm-hmm. Amal, with Moment Factory, you guys, like others, work all over the world, all kinds of different projects inside and out. I'm curious with things like airports, big public facilities, shopping malls, everything else, what's the aspiration of the owners and what's the ask? Do they have a clear idea of what they want to do or do they just say, we want something cool?
Well, I think I would come back to a couple of the things that David Niles and Sibel mentioned. One is they're looking for instant destination. They want a place to be top of mind in the public's imagination as a place to go and experience something meaningful. And in terms of its relationship to the individuals that visit that space, Sibel touched on a word that I find really important, which is responsive, that in today's, you know, experience economy, let's call it that, you look at folks like Joe Pinner already talking about after the experience economy, people don't just want to be spectators. They want to be participants. They want to be contributors to the experience that surrounds them. And those two layers combined are extremely important in terms of creating destinations that that actually engage people in a meaningful way and don't just entertain them and certainly don't just bombard them with advertisements. So that hierarchy of placemaking, I guess, is really important. You look at an airport, for example, like LAX, and you look at the economics, can seem daunting to some developers, but you know, a $70 million platform for all of their digital ecosystem is a small light item, probably comparable to the Marble in that space. On a $2.5 billion terminal. But what happens when you actually invest a space like that with a storytelling, like Emily said, with meaning? Well, if you look at the retail platform in Tom Bradley Airport, it is by every standard, the most profitable, highest rent retail space, not only in the company that administers its portfolio, but in North American real estate. And if you know airports, you know, more than 50% of the revenues come from retail F&B, not from airline transportation related stuff. So they're essentially a shopping center that allows people to get other places fast. And what they want, if I come back to sort of David and the destination aspect, they've traditionally counted on starkitecture, you know, over the past thousands of years of public spaces. What combination of marble and stone and steel and glass is going to create a space special enough that people will come and see it? And nowadays we can literally build with light, and integrate that into a space, so that it's not just an architectural program, but it's programmable. And that's where I would say we're seeing the huge convergence, not only technologically, but in terms of the vision of what a space is. Our clients come and they don't want just a program. They want to be able to program and communicate and engage with their visitors before, during, and after. So having attraction element is important, but also duration, you know, keeping people in a space and happy in a space for a long time, creating levels of engagement that we couldn't have before. So not just people come, people go, we don't know who they were, but can we actually develop a conversation with those folks? And ultimately the whole love that people feel for a space and share for a space is extremely important.
How important, I'll put this out to the group, is it for the technology to be readily changeable? I've wondered with commercial property groups if they're particularly attracted to the idea of digital, because you can install a lobby and set a look for it. And if the owners say, I don't like this anymore, it's not a $20 million construction job, it's a file change. Is that just in my head, or is that important?
Hugely important from my perspective. I mean, I think the type of clients who understand that they want a digital component in their building are thinking about innovation, and coming along with that is anticipating change, right? Every organization changes, the voice of every building in every organization will change. And so if you don't have an ability to change that in your environment, then you're kind of not ahead of the eight ball. And so the conversation then becomes, do you, owner, operator, want to be responsible for changing it? Or do you want somebody else to be responsible for changing it with you? And how much of the change can be built into the platform upon opening it, so that it has the ability to change over time and you're not continuing to sort of feed the beast of these systems? You have to design the content intentionally from the beginning to make it worthwhile and make it have duration. And if you aren't thinking about it that way, if you're thinking, oh, let me put a digital screen in and think about the content later, it's not going to have a real meaningful content plan. And so you have to design those things in parallel.
David, I suspect you have something to say about feeding the beast. You were telling me about the amount of content changes you're making in Comcast.
Yes. Well, that's a good question. It's a complicated question because there's two components to that. And those components are the physical installation of whatever the hardware or the display is going to be, and the amount of success that the initial content has in that space, in that digital space. Now, obviously, it's very easy to change the content. That's just making new content, and that supposedly would renew the space. But sometimes the initial physical installation of those screens, how they are, you know, in the three-dimensional space, also sometimes requires change. In particularly in Comcast, the initial request was to make sure that the content was not going to get old or would need to be reviewed, you know, renewed after several months. So we had to come up with a scheme and a concept that would allow for, at Comcast request, 2 years of content at the onset that would be ever changing and not requiring refreshing. Now that's not to say that there are not scenarios that don't repeat. We call those evergreen, but there are other components of that content that change on a designed randomness, which is a little harder to explain, that if you came into the Comcast lobby at 8 o'clock in the morning on Monday, you might see a specific scenario playing. And if you came in on Tuesday, you might see something similar, but there's something different about it. If you came in on Wednesday at the same time, you'll see something similar, but something different about it. And building those, all of that content, if it was just straight playouts and scenarios, would be economically not feasible. I mean, that's 18 hours a day, 7 days a week. So we have this whole system of designed interchangeable components that are modified by a content delivery system that we built that follows an arc of a day or interaction with things that go on inside of lobby as to time of day, traffic in the lobby, things like that. So it's ever changing. And that was, it's different, you know, coming from a background of broadcast television or theater, which is sort of my DNA, you know, where we have a linear show that doesn't really change, figuring out ways to make these components interchangeable to create this many, many different pieces of content from common elements.
Right. Jeremy, I think you're going to jump in.
Yeah, I was going to chime in here and say, in working with a lot of different real estate developers, a lot of cities have mandated that they developers actually integrate art into their projects. In a lot of discussions with the cities, I've tried to emphasize digital and using digital as a canvas, essentially, and providing that then to the community and the communities such as schools and universities to provide that canvas to them to be able to place art on that digital canvas at, let's say, a shopping center or a commercial property, which the whole purpose of a shopping center or any of these venues is to drive traffic and unique experiences too. So if you can drive and have creative elements from a university or school that have created some great looking pieces of art and have an event around that at a property that drives traffic and hopefully sales for that property as well. So it's a lot of the time is working with municipalities these days, which are also sometimes not in love with digital. And then how do you continue to keep that content fresh on a regular basis?
For the group, one of the things that I've seen in a number of buildings, I'm thinking of the Salesforce out in San Francisco and some other ones where they've used visualized data. And the thing that's attractive about visualized data is you can set it and forget it. It's just going to change and do its own thing. So it's great from an economic standpoint and operational standpoint because you set it and you don't worry about it anymore. But does it struggle for relevance? Like, do people know what they're looking at? And is it appropriate to the environment or is it just like moving art?
I'll jump in with an anecdote because I think, you know, we'd all agree that generative content that somehow, you know, renews itself on its own because of some algorithm is an important way of filling time, screen time in a creative way without needing to go back to the, you know, another artist production. But it's extremely difficult to make those pieces readable. They're very interesting as an art piece. As actually communicating the data that's behind them, I think the closest we've come is either very literal with a dashboard that explains it. And that's interesting in the case of a corporate headquarter lobby where they've got data on one side and kind of look at what it is. And then on the other side, it's expressing itself in a creative way. LAX Airport, though, had a really interesting, it was quite first degree when that came online in 2013, and the digital departure board there was driven, the art on there was driven by the weather conditions coming from the destination airports. So you would have Tokyo would be up on the screen, and then you'd have a sort of geographic representation of Tokyo, and the wind direction would be pushing particles in one way across the screen. What actually happened in the first few months that we actually launched LAX was that we got a call and said, guys, log in and change something because there's a weather event, a 500-year weather event in Tokyo, and it's outside of our parameters. So the parameters that we had set based on all historical records of Tokyo, well, that got flushed when the algorithm didn't know what to do with like 300 kilometer an hour winds. And they said people are getting freaked out by the board. So it's all a, and so we went in and modified the algorithms to expand it out to, you know, to tone things down so people wouldn't be scared to get on an airplane. It can serve, you know, very great purposes, but you're always within some kind of algorithm that is either trying to set a mood or amplify some aspect of the experience of the visitors on the, in a site.
I think that the question for me is, when do you need it to be understood and when do you need it to be artistic? You know, there's times when you know that people are going to be pausing, that there's going to be duration, that they have time to digest information and that they want to, they're in the right mindset. And then there's other areas where you need to just be evocative and inspirational and sort of allow people to see something interesting and inspiring. And so it's sort of less about, is this particular thing understandable in terms of the data that's driving it, or more so, should it be? You know, in a corporate campus, for example, you can look at all sorts of data within an organization and figure out ways to visualize that in really interesting ways. But maybe if you're moving through a lobby, you don't need it to be so data information heavy. It can be data driven, but not data understood. So it really kind of depends on the audience and the place. And that's why everything has to be curated to be site specific. You know, there's a lot of different data sets that can be used to just create change, as everybody's been saying here, movement, weather, Twitter, Instagram, you know, there's many different things you can look at to create change, but mapping it to sort of the mindset of the person as they're moving through the space is sort of where you decide whether you need those high impact moments or more sort of inspirational moments.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Gavin, CEO of ScreenFeed. Now, I'm not put off by the fact that you're not listening to this podcast to hear me. Just like audiences to any digital signage, you give your attention to content you find interesting or helpful. That's where my company ScreenFeed comes in. Our sole mission is to make your digital signage network more valuable by making content that is more valuable to your audience. If you'd like to drive more attention to your screens, visit ScreenFeed.com to explore the 75-plus content options we've created to do just that. And then give us a call. Now, back to the podcast.
At ESI, I can think of one project in particular that was very, very subtle in terms of what it was doing. The Terrell Place, where, for instance, you had cherry blossoms and movement or time of day. I'm not quite sure what, but the blossoms would fall.
Yeah, it's a couple different layers. We used cameras embedded in the ceiling to track motion of people as they move through the lobby. And then we use that data to affect what's happening on screen. And I apologize, of course, the lawnmower guy happens to be here right now. we built in some of that data to be sort of visualized in the moment, but then we also have seasonal components. So over time, there's a cherry blossom scene that's relevant. Is that bothering everybody? Should I go on? Okay, no problem. All right. So, you know, we have a series of different media modes that play out over the course of the day to make change in the environment. And then for the one that's about the seasonality, we looked at cherry blossoms because it is in Washington, D.C. That's a relatable moment for people coming through the lobby. And then over the course of the year, we map out how that scene should change. So in wintertime, it's more of a frozen scene. In spring, it's blooming. So you can build in things that change daily, change by the minute. And there's things that can be built in and baked into the system to allow it to have change over the course of the year. And so I think you have to look at all those metrics and decide, given the media moment that you happen to be in, should it change immediately, or should just have a larger organization and choreography over the course of a year, so to speak.
Sibel, I'm curious, when you hear this sort of thing and your members hear this sort of thing, are their minds blown, or are they just intimidated as hell, thinking this would be great, but I don't even know where to start?
I think it really runs the gamut. I mean, some of our members, like ESI and others, they're really at the forefront of this.
Yeah.
Everybody is realizing that it's important to at least have an understanding. I mean, one of the things I wanted to build on And I know there's some questions about ROI, but when we think about this, you know, my question always going into it is, what audience is it serving? And so if I look at David's project at Comcast, I happened to be there for a meeting and it was around the holidays and there were a million local kids plopped on their rear ends in the middle of this office lobby waiting for the Nutcracker or whatever the digital performance is. And you might say, well, you know, this is totally out of character of maybe what Comcast wants to happen in their lobby to have a million, you know, Philadelphia school kids. But if you think about that connection that they're building with the brand, you know, they might think when they're a teenager, they'll remember back Comcast with these like wonderful memories of going for the holiday celebration. So I think, you know, for our group at SCDD, we're all about what audiences are we serving. And the really interesting thing about these digital platforms is that, and using like Terrell Place or, you know, LAX, you have a different relationship dependent on what scale you're at. So if I'm someone who works in the office and these digital interfaces are responding to me, I'm going to have a more potentially intimate or, you know, relationship about the kind of information. If I'm, you know, I think about our organization, SCDD, about placemaking, you know, I live in the DC area. The Terrell experience affects just the passerbys, you know, the people that are walking on the street. It could affect my mood because I happen to look over, have a super stressful day, but I'm seeing these beautiful cherry blossoms. So I think we do understand as practitioners that digital interfaces create a different way to allow us to engage and create ebb and flow with our different audiences at different scales. And so, you know, a real estate person might go in thinking one thing, well, I want to attract, you know, a higher class of tenant. But on the other hand, they have the ability, like Comcast and others, to have this much greater impact on, say, downtown DC, or the way in which the whole perceived value of a neighborhood is just by this activation. So we really have to embrace that, and we have to understand the impact that it has on our communities.
And David, you said that Comcast specifically thought in terms of this lobby becoming a destination and having a holiday experience and doing all those things, and that you've seen millions of people come through those lobbies or that lobby.
Yeah, it's especially the holiday show is, I mean, when Comcast is running in its normal daily routine, there's about 1,200 one-minute scenarios that play every day. But from Thanksgiving Day until January 1st, we created a holiday spectacular. And this holiday spectacular is an 18-minute show that is different than the rotating scenarios. It goes on every hour. And literally from the first year that we started doing that, which was 12 years ago, that holiday show, and this amazes me, has drawn, that lobby fills up with thousands of people every hour, like clockwork. And there's no reason to, I mean, the lobby's got no seating in it. It's not really very comfortable, but it's literally people pack into that for the 8 shows that we do every day. And it's amazing to watch people of all ages. The ROI for Comcast is they are good community people. They're giving something back to the city because they've made this yearly event, this thing to come to Comcast, and it's I'm amazed by it that it's been that popular. I think it's a good thing. I think it's a great thing.
When we talk about these kinds of projects, I wonder if there are integrators and other people in the ecosystem, including property owners, saying, this all sounds amazing, but my client is not Comcast, or I'm not Comcast, or I'm not a giant corporation of some kind. I would like to do something in my lobby, but I don't have that kind of budget to put in a $10 million LED video wall and do this and that. Jeremy, I'm curious, because you're probably working with clients at all kinds of different tiers of budget and aspiration and everything else. Is there a way to do really great work that's a little more modest in terms of budget and everything else and technology challenge?
It's funny you say that. I was actually working with a client, and we gave them the pricing just recently of how much all this digital signage that they wanted to do, and then they said we can't afford any of that. So there's a lot of companies out there that can provide financing options. I should say that, and it's a good way to move forward at low rates, low interest rates, and maybe it's as I said to clients, start off small. Sometimes walk before you run. Work with one location. Let's prove it. Prove out the model, and then if it works, then let's go to the next location. But you know, there's a lot of clients, unfortunately, in the retail and the commercial industry that are suffering in this time, and sometimes digital signage might be considered a luxury. So everyone's trying to figure out how do you place it in and keep the content fresh, generate revenue potentially, or create buzz there, but do it in a seamless manner.
I would say that the conversations that I'm hearing from the big developers around the world, and there's two aspects to them. There's the developers themselves, and there's the tenants that they want to attract, whether they're retail or commercial space. But they're saying they can't afford not to have digital these days. You know, they're very afraid if they're commercial of their building, like Emily mentioned, being the building that people choose not to go to when people do come back to the office. Why would I choose your building over another? And an ecosystem that allows for a dialogue and a relationship and an enhanced experience between tenants, visitors, like David Niles are referred to in the Comcast Center, and the building owners themselves, who are highly invested in the success of their property. Mm-hmm. But traditionally, they've built a shell, clapped themselves on their back, and waited for people to lease it. And those people who lease it have had the relationship with whatever public, staff or consumers, if it's a shopping center. And now they're realizing that the model is changing. And as a property owner, you need to have mechanisms that will draw visitorship to your site. And if you don't, all you've built is another shell like everybody else's. And so establishing a brand, a story, but also in a deeper way, getting into the identity of a place, but also the identity of the consumers and people, workers, visitors, live, work, play people coming through your space is critical. You can't afford not to have it these days, because you will be the empty shell at some point.
I think to add to that, I think retailers now are trying to think about how do you create those digital unique experiences with not only digital, but also how do you combine that with a brand and an event with that digital experience inside their venues. So it's people want these days unique experiences that they can't get online and that they have to get in person. So that's what I see a lot of retailers looking at. At the same time, the price tag is one of the things that they look at, unfortunately.
I think, you know, for us, the way we think about it is what's the whole experience of somebody coming before they get there, when they get there, and then moving through the space and then leaving, right? And so you can map that out and look at what the experience needs to be at all those touch points. How do you want to welcome people? How do you want to greet people? So that's more of a threshold experience. What do you do when they're maybe waiting at the elevators? That's maybe something that has a little bit more duration. And once you get to kind of crystallizing the goals at each one of those touch points, some of them might result in a digital intervention. Others might be achieved with a more analog or material intervention. And so I think you can prioritize them once you really get into the nitty gritty of mapping out sort of where the key and most sort of opportune moments are for a digital intervention. But to me, the digital is just another medium in the palette of materials you can use to kind of activate a site. And so you don't have to look at one place and be like, it's got to be digital everywhere. You can cover area and cover square footage with very low res tech, lighting, color, you know, just paint. These things can all be combined together to create one opportunity for one really iconic moment. So it's not sort of starting with the tech first. It's starting with the design of the experience and then figuring out where is the right place to put digital. And that can really help right size a budget and then allows you to map to the experience, not the technology.
I get a sense that, and David was talking about this when I was chatting with him for a podcast, that if you're going to do big visuals in a lobby or some other signature place, that it better not be about advertising. Like when you walk into the Comcast building, you don't see Comcast ads. You don't see, get your fiber account now, $20 off or anything else. Is that a pretty standard rule of thumb that when you're doing these things, it's about experience, it's not about selling?
Well, I think that you have to look at advertising in a different way. There is a way to make advertising. Movie people do it in a very easy way called just product placement. You know, you've created something that doesn't look like an ad, but actually there's a box of Kellogg's, you know, on the kitchen table. By the way, I'm very sorry, but it looks like I lost you guys for a little while there. My internet out here in the wilder.
Your face froze, but your audio was fine.
Okay. My video is still here, but that's okay. But I think that there's, you know, you can't really take an advertisement that's been cut and made for a television picture in a specific environment or anything else and say, okay, well, we're going to put it, you know, digitally inside of a building lobby because it seems to make sense. But there's a way to rethink the advertising, restructure the advertising, and actually make commercial messaging without it being so blatantly obvious. One other point that I wanted to make before my internet disappeared for a minute, and that has to do with budgetary things, specifically about Comcast. One of the other challenges that Comcast put out, and rightly so, it's a building lobby. There is a reasonable expectation for what content should cost. It's not a broadcast station. It's not, you know, it's there's no direct return of money coming in. So there is what we define as a reasonable budget. And to work within that reasonable budget is one of the challenges of making things for large-scale digital installations in lobbies. I just wanted to make that point. I'm sorry. That was from time ago.
And just one of the experiences I had, just to add to this, was we created a holiday spectacular many years ago. And right at the beginning of the show, we said the show was brought to you by major brands like PayPal, Samsung, and so forth. So it wasn't in-your-face advertising. It was a five-minute show, but it was brought to you by these mm-hmm. brands. And so it was, you know, a great event for the consumers that was, you know, they appreciate it. And the brands love that because, you know what, it was an authentic experience that they were able to be associated with, and they love that.
We dealt with advertising in a project we recently did in a retail shopping center. We did a big digital ceiling. And, you know, that's in that instance, we had sort of media moments that were playing out as default things over the course of the day. But we also created a template that the retailers themselves could input their products into, and then created a curation system that allowed those products to feel like they belonged in the space. So not only was it something that made advertising a little bit more digestible for people coming through there, it provided a tool to the retailers. So suddenly, not you as the owner can draw in retail tenants because you're saying, hey, you don't have to spend so much money on advertising because we have that system built in for you. And here it is. And it becomes something that is actually intentionally designed for the space, because when you're talking about advertising in its pure form, it's normally fast paced. It's supposed to be about, you know, 30 seconds, 1 minute. That's not what you want in a long-term built environment that people move through every single day. Not only will people not look at it, it's just visually chaotic. And so you have to think about big, massive installations in a different pace, in a different rhythm, and having a different purpose than what advertising in its purest form is doing.
Amal, this is a bit of a sidetrack, but I think it's interesting to talk in terms of monetization. In Montreal, where you live, there's the Notre Dame Cathedral, and for the last 2-3 years at least, you've done a light show, or Moment Factory's done a light show in the cathedral. And what it did was take them away from donation boxes or tins to a paid event that went on, what, twice a night or something like that? And it's made a huge difference in terms of the cathedral's revenues, a restoration fund and everything else, right?
Yeah, it's made a huge difference, not only for the cathedral, but for the whole city of Montreal and the Quebec economy. The if you look at a project that cost X, the net benefits each year to the economy, the local economy, have been 10 times that. The metrics of success of a destination are really important. And in this case, the cathedral has been, until COVID hit, was unremovable from the number one out of 400 things to see and do on TripAdvisor. And so if you had time to see one thing, likely was you were going to go see that. The installation itself, an immersive mapping of the inside of the cathedral, as well as some of the artworks around the perimeter, essentially was a plug and play installation. You can hit play. It's a spectacle. So it's the same thing every time you see it. But runs for essentially an hour in terms of the overall in and out. And in the peak season, it was 3 nights, 3 hours per evening. And in the shoulder seasons, 2 or 1 hour representation, and with about 500-600 seats available and pretty much sold out every night of the past 3 years. That almost paid itself off in its first year of operation. Wow. So I agree with Jeremy that the sticker can be daunting for people, but the ROI, either direct and or indirect, we're just starting to see a sophisticated generation of decision makers coming out in destination development who actually know what a visitor is worth. I talked to a shopping center, you talk to Toronto Eaton Center or something like that, they've got 50, 60, 70, 80 million visitors a year. If there's nobody like today, in a lockdown situation, what a visitor is worth. And if it takes money to make money. So if you're in the bricks and mortar business, you're not in it for the fun. You're not in it for art. But it may be that these creative layers are really important. And just going to one of the questions that I saw go by from one of the folks in the Q&A chat, there was a question about, how do you manage contracts between the content side and the equipment side. And we're seeing the coming together of two departments in developers that were traditionally extremely separate. One was the people with the big bucks, which were the development silo. And then you had the marketing silo, and they were responsible for inheriting and activating this jewel box that has passed on to them from the people who knew better on the architecture development side. And now, and for, dozens of years, hundreds of years, the marketing side has said, okay, what can we do with this space? And the response mostly was, well, please just don't bother it. It's an architectural precious piece, and just admire it and enjoy it. And marketing departments have an extremely important role in 2020 of activating a space. And they do not tolerate, and they have the budgets now, to not tolerate having space that can't be programmed in some way. And so, having a relationship with both sides of that, making the building operations and development side happy through the architectural process, but delivering something that actually serves the survival of that destination through the marketing side is where I'm seeing a totally new generation of, executives coming into the development market these days.
Interesting. Marcella, we have about 5 minutes left and we've got a number of questions. Did you want to take a couple of those on and pose them to the group?
Yes, definitely. So Deanna was asking, have you discussed or plan to discuss advancements in displays where external media players are not always necessary, reducing the costs of going digital?
Who wants that one?
I think it depends on how complex the visuals are and how much you're rendering in real time, meaning how much data you're actively ingesting and needing to process on site versus how much you're pre-producing. I think for us when we're trying to capture things happening on site and using them to drive what's happening in the space. That often takes a real-time processing component. Some of that can happen in the cloud. It doesn't have to be literally in the rack room, but it's a hard thing to answer holistically. I think there's some scenarios where you can have things sort of set within the system and not needing external devices. But I think a lot of times, if you want to be really highly tuned into what's happening in the space, you still need some processing to happen in real time from the work that we're doing.
Yeah, I've certainly, and Jeremy could probably chime in on this, but I've certainly heard for a lot of the signature projects that are out there, like let's say the Netflix lobby in LA, you're not using regular kit. You had to build like a, or have a custom media server done because you're talking about 16,000 pixel canvases, that kind of thing. Jeremy, what's been your experience?
No, you're 1,000% correct. Maybe one day, and maybe it's going to be on small screens. That's where I could see it, on maybe digital kiosks, but on the large format LEDs, I don't see it happening in the near future.
All right, Michelle.
Next question is from Joel. Absent of COVID-19 non-touchable walls, can we consider digital images in large public places as digital waterfalls? He says, as a kid, waterfalls in shopping malls and public parks were beautiful features, let's say pleasant advertising or brand enforcement.
I think, if I can respond, I think at its most basic answer to that, delivering an experience that is not just efficient, but is meaningful and memorable has been the point of those kind of features forever. And today, if you look at the kind of things that evolved from our work, for example, at LAX to then Changi Airport, when Changi called us up, they said, we have a few key things we want to achieve, such as a security zone pain point that we want to resolve that you didn't do at LAX. We're going to make it efficient, but no matter how efficient you make something, nobody's going to love it. And so our challenge to you is to turn the experience of this pain point in our destination into a plus, that people would regret going through security as fast as they did and wish they just had another 30 seconds. So that was the challenge they put on the table. Give us a security zone experience that people wish lasted longer. Can you do that? And ultimately, when they branded their T4 airport, if an airport is a shopping mall, essentially, but what did they call their, it wasn't the most efficient terminal ever. T4 was the theater of experience. And I wish it was us that proposed that to them, but that was what Changi wanted to be. They wanted to be the theater of experience. And they said, we're going to stay away from the LAX model with advertising content plastered all over it, where you actually saw the earned media value, social media value of it drop off the map as soon as advertising came up. No more images circulating, no more articles being written about it. We want to keep that engagement level high. And it's going to take creative content for dwell time features inside our retail zone that's going to attract people and have them happy being there for a while. But also, contribute to the overall experience as you come through the traditional pain points. And I think, the modern day waterfall is a very important aspect. The innovations that David and Emily's team have been bringing into the experience of arrival, entry, passage, and ultimately engagement in an environment are must-haves.
All right. We could have easily spoke for 3-4 hours, but I know you're all busy and this is supposed to last an hour.
That's it for this week's episode. I hope you enjoyed it and you learned a thing or two. If you're new to 16.9, it's a podcast that's been around since 2016. You can click around the site and find scores of conversations with smart industry folks. If you're new to digital signage, you need to be reading 16.9. That's at 16-9.net. You'll find thousands of posts by me and expert guest writers about this industry. I don't run a press release republishing mill. If something makes it on 16.9, that means it matters in some way to the business. Everything about 16.9 is free. Great sponsors make my work possible, and one of those is podcast sponsor ScreenFeed. Check them out at screenfeed.com. 16.9 is a product of Vertical Media Consulting Group, the massive media empire I run out of a spare room in my house, now located outside Halifax, Nova Scotia, on the east coast of Canada. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Haynes.